June 16th, 2009. Rosses Point, Ireland. The body of a man who appears to be in his late 50s or early 60s is found washed up on a beach, and his cause of death is believed to be acute cardiac arrest. 4 days earlier, the man had arrived in the nearby town of Sligo and checked into a hotel under the name Peter Bergman, but it turns out this name was fake, and he carries no identification. Investigators believe that he traveled to Ireland from another country and used CCTV footage to track his movements in the days prior to his death, but they are unable to uncover Peter Bergman's true identity. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be traveling to Ireland to cover a mystery involving an unidentified John Doe, the 2009 death of a man known only as Peter Bergman. I've received a few requests to cover this case, and while it has garnered a lot of publicity in Ireland this past decade, it does not appear to be that well known in North America. It's been a while since I've done an episode about an unidentified decedent, so I thought now would be an ideal time to tackle this story. The victim in question was a middle-aged man who traveled to the town of Sligo and checked into a hotel under the name Peter Bergman, but of course, it was eventually determined that this was not his real name. He stayed there for the next 3 nights before traveling to the nearby village of Rosses Point, where his body would be discovered on a beach the following morning. While it does not appear there was foul play involved, the exact circumstances of how Peter Bergman died are still unclear, and since he was heard speaking with an accent which sounded like it might be Austrian, his reasons for traveling to Ireland to begin with are still a mystery. There is evidence to suggest he spent his last days gradually disposing of all personal items which might have revealed his true identity and that he wanted to be completely forgotten about after he died. However, if that was his intention, the exact opposite result took place, as Peter Bergman has since become one of Ireland's most heavily discussed mysteries, and there have been numerous theories presented about his identity and backstory. In spite of the publicity this case has generated, no one has ever come forward who recognizes this man, so we're going to explore all the different theories on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the saga of Peter Bergman. Our story begins in 2009 in Rosses Point, Ireland, a small seaside village with a population of just under 900 people, located in County Sligo, next to the Atlantic Ocean. At around 6:45 a.m. on the morning of Tuesday, June the 16th, a father and son duo came across the body of a middle-aged man who had been washed up on one of the village's beaches and was lying face down in the sand. He appeared to be in his late 50s or early 60s and had closely cropped gray hair and a waterproof quartz watch on his left wrist. He was dressed in purple-striped Speedo-type swimming trunks with underwear over top and a navy t-shirt which was tucked into them. This prompted the duo to contact the Gardaí, aka the Irish police force, and when the medical examiner arrived at the scene, the victim was officially pronounced dead. Some additional articles of clothing, including black shoes, dark socks, a sleeveless Tommy Hilfiger jumper, a black leather jacket, a black leather belt, and neatly folded dark navy trousers, were found on a nearby rock and presumably belonged to the victim. Curiously, it turned out that the labels in every piece of clothing had been cut out. The various pockets of the clothing contained a number of items, including an envelope containing 149 euros worth of notes and coins, a package of tissues, 55 milligrams of aspirin, Hansa Plus sticking plasters, which are adhesive bandages, and a wrapped bar of hotel soap. However, no form of identification for this man could be found anywhere. While it initially appeared that he had drowned in the ocean and washed up on the beach, the autopsy revealed what the pathologist described as no sign of, quote-unquote, classical saltwater drowning, and there was no evidence that he had been the victim of foul play. However, it was apparent that the man had been suffering from some serious health problems as he was in the advanced stages of prostate cancer and had bone tumors, so even if he had not have died, he likely only had weeks left to live. His right kidney was missing, and he showed signs of previously having suffered multiple heart attacks. The man's teeth were in good condition and showed an extensive history of dental work, as he had bridging, root canals, and crowns, as well as a full gold tooth on the upper back right side of his mouth. But in spite of his health problems, the toxicology report showed no medication or painkillers in his system, including aspirin, even though aspirin tablets had been found among his possessions. This meant he likely would have been experiencing a great deal of pain at the time of his death. In the end, his official cause of death was ruled to be acute cardiac arrest. Since the decedent could not be identified and no one came forward who recognized him, investigators attempted to backtrack his movements as he frequently showed up on CCTV footage in the days prior to his death. It turned out that he originally showed up in the area on Friday, June the 12th, when he arrived at the nearby town of Sligo, located about 8 kilometers southeast of Ross's Point. Prior to that, the man was captured by cameras at the Ulster Bus Depot in the city of Derry. At the time, he was wearing glasses and dressed in a black leather jacket, with a small bag slung over his shoulder and a smaller black bag in his hand. He initially boarded a bus and asked if it was traveling to Sligo, and when he learned it wasn't, he subsequently boarded the correct bus, which left the depot at 4 p.m. CCTV footage would capture him arriving in Sligo at 6:28 p.m., and he proceeded to climb into a taxi and asked the driver to take him to a cheap hotel. The driver first took him to a hotel on Connolly Street, which turned out to have no vacancy, so he was next taken to the Sligo City Hotel on Quay Street. At 6:52, he rented out room 705 for 3 nights and registered under the name Peter Bergman. Of course, it would later turn out that Peter Bergman was a fake name, but that's how I'll refer to him from now on. The rate was 65 euros per night, and Peter paid for it in cash, but he was never asked to provide any identification. When he wrote his name in the register, he listed his address as Einstedersen 15, Wien 4472. Now, Wien just happened to be the German language name for Vienna, Austria, but the problem is that this address did not exist. Some sources state there is no such street as Einstedersen in Vienna, while others state that the address led to a vacant lot. While 4472 was meant to be a postal code, it also did not exist, as Vienna uses a 4-digit system where all the numbers begin with 1 instead of 4. Everyone who heard Peter speak described him as having what sounded like a thick Austrian or perhaps German accent, and he spoke English very well. After spending the night at the hotel, Peter would be captured visiting a nearby post office at 10:49 a.m., on the morning of Saturday, June the 13th. He would purchase 10 82-cent stamps and was also given airmail stickers, but while it was never conclusively determined if Peter mailed any letters, these stamps were not found among his possessions after he died. During his 3-night stay at the hotel, Peter mostly kept to himself, but during that time period, he would be captured on CCTV exiting the hotel no less than 13 times. On each occasion, he was shown carrying a purple plastic bag which appeared to contain items, but he was not carrying it whenever he returned. It was unclear if Peter might have folded the empty bag and placed it in one of his pockets when he came back, or if he just kept a large collection of purple bags inside his room. Investigators speculated that Peter may have been using the bags to dispose of all of his personal belongings in order to hide all potential clues to his identity. However, a thorough check of all CCTV footage in Sligo failed to capture Peter getting rid of any items, and even though a number of the local dumps, rubbish bins, and public areas were searched, they failed to turn up anything which could be traced back to him. Peter's movements almost seemed to indicate that he was aware of all the security cameras as blind spots, and he made the calculated decision to avoid them whenever he disposed of his belongings. On Sunday, June the 14th, Peter left the hotel between 11 and 11:30 a.m. and climbed into a taxi cab. According to the driver, Peter pulled out a map and asked him to recommend a quiet beach where he could go for a swim. After he recommended Ross's Point, the driver took him to the two beaches which were located there. When they arrived, Peter only climbed out of the taxi for a few moments to look at the area before he got back in and asked the driver to take him to the Sligo bus station. During the ride, Peter asked how often the buses traveled to that beach, and he also mentioned that he was from Austria. After Peter was dropped off at the bus station, he later returned to the hotel and requested a late checkout the following morning. At 1:06 p.m. on Monday, June the 15th, Peter finally checked out and left. He was described as wearing a black leather jacket, a long-sleeved pale blue shirt, a sleeveless Tommy Hilfiger jumper, and dark trousers. Even though most of these articles of clothing were later found on the beach, the long-sleeved blue shirt was never recovered. Peter was also seen carrying the same shoulder bag and handheld bag he had with him when he arrived in Sligo, as well as a purple plastic bag. When he left the hotel, Peter was captured on CCTV walking down Quay Street to the Quayside Shopping Center, where, for unknown reasons, he waited in the doorway for several minutes before walking away again at 1:16. At 1:32, Peter was shown arriving at the Sligo bus station, where he stopped at a small cafe and ordered a cappuccino and a toasted ham and cheese sandwich. Curiously, by this point, Peter was only carrying the purple bag and the bag strapped over his shoulder, but the smaller black bag he had been holding was no longer in his possession and has never been found. After he sat down at a table to eat, Peter pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket and wrote something down on it before he proceeded to tear it up and toss it into a nearby rubbish bin. When he finished eating, Peter soon asked an employee when the next bus to Ross's Point was, and he proceeded to purchase a one-way ticket before the bus left at 2:40 p.m. Starting at 4 o'clock that afternoon, no less than 16 witnesses would recall seeing Peter at the same beach he had visited in Ross's Point the previous day. These sightings would be spread out over the course of nearly 8 hours, and Peter was seen walking and pacing along the beach. Some of the witnesses reported him standing in the water in his bare feet, with his trousers rolled up to his knees, and at various points, he was seen with the black bag strapped over his shoulder. The last confirmed sighting was from a woman who saw him at 11:50 p.m., and he was still carrying the purple plastic bag and had his glasses on. At the time, the high tide was scheduled to arrive on the beach within the next half hour, and by the following morning, Peter's dead body would be discovered. In spite of all the articles of clothing and personal items he left behind on the beach, the black shoulder bag, the purple plastic bag, and Peter's glasses could not be found anywhere. Of course, the investigation would fail to uncover any passports or records for anyone under the name Peter Bergman matching this man's age or description in Europe, North America, or South America. While his DNA and fingerprints were obtained and circulated among various agencies, no match could be found. When the man known only as Peter Bergman could not be identified, he was buried in an unmarked grave in Sligo Town Cemetery in September of 2009. This plot was specifically purchased to bury unclaimed bodies and can hold up to 3 people, so Peter currently has another unidentified decedent buried alongside him. In 2013, this story became the subject of a 19-minute documentary titled The Last Days of Peter Bergman, which was screened at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival and won the Best Documentary Short Film Award at the 2014 Melbourne International Film Festival. The director, Kieran Cassidy, has speculated that Peter may have traveled to the beach at Ross's Point in hopes of being washed away into the Atlantic Ocean, stating, quote, "Bergman must have wanted to disappear forever into the Atlantic, but alas, for him, the ocean rejected his body, and now he lies in an unmarked grave in Sligo," end quote. As a result, this story has become one of Ireland's biggest mysteries of the modern era, and the true identity of the middle-aged man named Peter Bergman remains unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. If you're a true crime follower, you probably know that the last few years have been a pretty amazing time when it comes to identifying John and Jane Doe's. There are so many cases involving decedents who have remained unidentified for years, if not decades, but organizations such as the DNA Doe Project have been using such methods as genetic genealogy to track down these victims as biological relatives and find out who they are. In many of these cases, the public only has an idea of what the decedent looked like through computer-generated composite sketches, but what makes the story of Peter Bergman stand out is that he was captured on CCTV several times prior to his death, so we know what he actually looked like. These images are easily available for viewing online, yet no one has ever come forward to say that they recognize this man. You may have already noticed that Peter's story has a number of similarities to some of the most famous cases involving unidentified decedents. For instance, there's the Tamam Shud case, aka the Mystery of the Somerton Man, which involves an unidentified middle-aged male who was found dead on the Somerton Park beach in Australia in 1948. Much like Peter Bergman, all of the labels in the Somerton Man's clothing were removed, and it seemed like he had gone to great lengths to conceal his true identity. Peter's story is also reminiscent of two other individuals who checked into hotels under false names before they turned up dead. If you've watched the most recent season of the Unsolved Mysteries reboot on Netflix, you're probably familiar with the unidentified woman who checked into the Oslo Plaza Hotel in Norway under the name Jennifer Fairgate in 1995. Like Peter, she was never asked to provide any identification and booked the room for 3 nights, and she would eventually be found dead on her bed after an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. In both the Somerton Man and Jennifer Fairgate cases, one of the most prominent theories is that they were spies, so I suppose it's not surprising that this theory has also been presented with Peter Bergman as well. The other famous case I was referring to took place in September of 2001, involving a young man who checked into a motel in Amanda Park, Washington, under the false name Lyle Stevick, before he subsequently hanged himself in the closet. In May of 2018, it was announced that the DNA Doe Project had used genetic genealogy to track down Lyle's biological family, but in the interest of privacy, all details about his true identity and backstory have been kept secret from the public. It's always been theorized that Lyle Stevick may have taken steps to ensure his family never found out what happened to him, and it's possible that Peter Bergman may have done the same thing. So I suppose we should now address the question about whether or not Peter should be identified. In June of 2019, the Irish Times released a 3-part podcast about this case titled Atlantic, The Unsolved Mystery of Peter Bergman, hosted by journalist Rosita Boland. At one point, Boland did address the potential ethical issues of trying to uncover Peter's identity. If he took all these steps to ensure he could not be identified, should everyone respect his wishes and let him rest in peace? It would be one thing if foul play had taken place and a homicide investigation was required, but there are cases in which decedents died by suicide and it was apparent that they just wanted to be left alone and forgotten about. However, I've always personally held the belief that no matter what their final wishes may have been, there still needs to be an investigation to find out who they were. I've mentioned this particular case on the podcast so many times that I must sound like a broken record, but once again, I must hearken back to the Gail Delano case, which has always been a serious influence on my opinion about this topic. As a quick refresher, Gail Delano vanished from her hometown in Maine and her disappearance would be featured on Unsolved Mysteries, until a medical examiner who watched the show recognized Gale as a Jane Doe he had found dead inside a hotel room in Mobile, Alabama, 2 years earlier. For reasons that are known only to her, Gale had decided to travel there and register at the hotel under a false name before she overdosed. It's possible she did not want her relatives to ever find out what happened to her, and while it's true that some of these decedents might have been estranged from their own families, that was definitely not the case with Gale. You could clearly tell that her family was suffering during their Unsolved Mysteries interviews, and it would have been a major tragedy if Gale had remained a missing person, and they had to keep living with this uncertainty for the rest of their lives. While it's possible that Peter Bergman was a complete loner with no family or friends, he may have loved ones out there somewhere who spent the past decade not knowing what happened to him. For this reason, I believe there is an obligation to keep seeking out his true identity. Now, what separates Peter's story from the other cases I've discussed is that the autopsy showed he was in the advanced stages of prostate cancer, so no matter what, it seemed like he was not going to live much longer than a couple of weeks. It sounds like he wanted to spend some time in County Sligo before ending his life on his own terms, but the big mystery is where did he come from, and why did he choose this particular location? When he was interviewed for an article about this case in Vice magazine in October of 2019, Detective Inspector Ray Maldarig of the Sligo Gardaí expressed his belief that Peter had chosen to travel to Sligo for a reason. He stated, quote, "There seems to have been a purpose to it. Everything he did seemed to have had a purpose, from cutting the labels of his clothes and all the rest of it. The question you have to ask is, why Sligo? If you want a scenic place to die, you're spoilt for choice across the west coast of Ireland, or even Scotland for that matter. Something must have brought him here, even if we've never been able to say what that was." End quote. Indeed, the consensus seems to be that Peter was definitely not a native of Ireland and likely hailed from Austria or possibly even Germany, so what made him travel to County Sligo? Another complication in this case is that even though Peter's actions suggest he had planned an elaborate suicide, we can't even be 100% certain how Peter died. I'm going to make another comparison to a case I featured on the podcast 4 years ago, which also has similarities to this one, and that's the 2014 death of Alan Giel. Alan was a 64-year-old man whose nude body was found washed up on Perranporth Beach in England, and he was not carrying any identification. In fact, the only reason Alan was identified was because he had been carrying an old photograph of himself as a toddler, and his siblings recognized it when it was circulated throughout the media. It turned out that Alan lived in another town located 25 miles away, and much like Peter Bergman, CCTV footage would track Alan's movements in the hours prior to his death, but no one could figure out why he traveled to Perranporth or if he died by suicide, homicide, or accidental drowning. And to make another comparison to Peter's case, Alan's clothing and a lot of the personal items he had been carrying were never recovered. Alan was pretty much considered to be a loner, and he may have planned to travel to a location he found comforting in order to end his own life. You get the sense that this was the same situation with Peter, and that for whatever reason, he decided that the beach in Ross's Point would be the ideal final destination. It's been theorized that Peter may have wanted to drown himself and hoped that his body would be washed away into the Atlantic Ocean forever, but it sounds like there was just not enough salt water in his lungs for his cause of death to have been drowning. I really don't get the impression there was any foul play involved, and the medical examiner seemed to believe that Peter had died of acute cardiac arrest. Suffering a fatal heart attack at the exact same time you're planning to kill yourself seems like one hell of a coincidence, but given how the autopsy indicated that Peter likely had a prior history of heart attacks, I suppose it's not impossible. I previously mentioned that this story was featured in a short documentary titled The Last Days of Peter Bergman, and if you go on YouTube, you can find handheld footage of a Q&A with the director, Kieran Cassidy, following its screening at the Sundance Film Festival. Cassidy says that the coroner told him he suspected Peter may have taken a fatal dose of cyanide to end his life, but I have not seen this information corroborated by any other sources. However, even though no medication or drugs were found in Peter's system, I guess he could have ingested something which caused his death and was never detected during the autopsy. But before we talk more about Peter's death, let's go back to the beginning and track his movements. The first CCTV footage of Peter showed him at the bus depot in Derry before he made the 135-kilometer trip to Sligo. Since it seems very unlikely that Peter was an Irish citizen, he had to travel from somewhere, possibly Austria, in order to arrive in Derry. This would have required the usage of a passport, but he probably got rid of it at some point, and since we don't know his real name, that makes it very difficult to track down when he originally entered the country. Now, in spite of all the theorizing about how Peter chose Sligo for a reason, his actions when he arrived give off the impression that he wasn't all that familiar with the city. The bus station was only about a 15-minute walk away from the Sligo City Hotel, so there really was no need for him to take a taxi, but since he apparently asked the driver to find him a cheap place to stay, it does not seem like he had much idea where to go. He never made a reservation anywhere, and he only wound up staying at the Sligo City Hotel because the first hotel he tried was full. And much like the Jennifer Fairgate case, it's very frustrating that the desk clerk did not ask Peter for identification when he checked in, even though it was supposedly standard policy in Ireland for all hotels to require ID from their guests. If Peter had been asked to produce an ID, who knows how he would have reacted and if things might have turned out differently. Instead, he was allowed to provide a fake name and address, and there has been endless speculation about their potential significance. Now for starters, I'll clarify that the spelling of this street name he provided, Ain't Stetterson, is A-I-N-S-T-E-T-T-E-R-S-N. There's been differing accounts from different sources about whether this address from Vienna led to a vacant lot or just never existed in the first place. I know that if you type Ain't Stetterson into Google, the only matches you get are sources related to this case, so I wonder if it might have been a misspelling of some sort, or if Peter just made the name up. The thing with the postal code he provided, 4472, is that even though Vienna's four-digit postal codes only begin with 1, there is a section of Upper Austria which does use that particular number, but it doesn't sound like investigators ever found any significance to it. And of course you have to wonder if there's a reason why he chose the name Peter Bergman. Bergman was spelled with 2 N's, not 1, and if you type that name into Google, you'll get a Wikipedia page for a prominent German-American physicist named Peter Bergman, who worked with Albert Einstein and published a couple of textbooks on such topics as general relativity before his death in 2002. But it's possible this connection is nothing more than a coincidence, and the name provides no clues at all about this man's true identity. Unlike the aforementioned Jennifer Fairgate and Lyle Stevic cases, Peter did not die until after he checked out of the hotel, so you have to wonder about his reasons for staying in Sligo for 3 nights. In the Last Days of Peter Bergman documentary, the hotel manager shared a story about an incident in which she visited Peter's room and knocked on the door, but received no answer. When she decided to unlock the door and go inside, she saw Peter standing in the doorway with a startled look on his face, and he almost appeared like he had been caught in the middle of doing something. But then he apparently gave off a look which seemed to indicate that he was relieved that it was only a member of the hotel staff who was visiting him. So I don't know if this can be seen as a sign that Peter might have traveled to Sligo to hide from someone. Of course, you can understand why Peter might have valued his privacy, as the CCTV footage captured him exiting the hotel no less than 13 times while carrying a purple plastic bag, and then returning at a later time with nothing in his hands. This is why investigators believe that Peter spent his entire 3-night hotel stay gradually disposing of most of his personal possessions and taking steps to ensure that no one would ever be able to figure out his true identity. We saw another example of this when Peter was shown checking out of the hotel with 3 bags in his hand, but he was only carrying 2 of these bags when CCTV footage captured him arriving at the bus station less than 30 minutes later. So I'm guessing he had some additional items in that bag he wanted to get rid of. The authorities were unable to recover any of the possessions that Peter supposedly disposed of, but the problem is that they really didn't have any idea what they were looking for, and I'm not sure if these items would have had any distinctive characteristics to prove they belonged to him. Since Peter was never shown getting rid of any items on CCTV, it's been theorized that he knew the cameras' blind spots and went out of his way to avoid them. I mean, this is why I've seen online sleuths speculate that Peter might have been in the police or the military or had experience as a spy because he had the necessary skills and training to avoid security cameras. However, this seems to contradict the assertion that Peter did not have much familiarity with Sligo, as he seemed to know so little about the downtown area that he had to ask the taxi driver to find him a hotel when he first arrived. So how would he have known where all the CCTV cameras were? I have a feeling that him not being captured on camera disposing of any possessions was due more to luck than anything. Now, the one thing we do know about Peter's stay in Sligo is that he stopped by the post office and purchased airmail stickers and 10 82-cent stamps. While it's never been officially confirmed that he mailed any letters, the fact that these stamps and stickers were not found on him when he died would imply that he did. While it's easy to believe that Peter was some loner who did not have any family or friends, I'm not sure why he would have felt the need to mail out any letters. But if he did have family and friends, then these actions do make sense, especially if he knew he was going to die sometime in the near future. However, not one person has ever come forward to say they received any letters from him, which would be all the more surprising if he mailed them to 10 separate people. At that time, the postage to mail a letter to someone in Ireland was 55 cents, and it was 82 cents to mail something outside the country, so the fact that he purchased 82-cent stamps obviously indicates that any letters he sent had an international destination. And that's been one of the big complicating factors with identifying Peter Bergman, because even though this story got extensive coverage in Ireland, it's very unlikely that he was an Irish citizen, and I'm not sure how well known his case is in other countries. If Peter hailed from Austria or Germany, and his friends and family received some letters there, they may have no idea that he became an unidentified John Doe in Ireland. According to a 2015 article in the French newspaper Le Monde, the Austrian authorities claim they were never contacted by the Gardaí about this case, so I don't know how much effort has been spent attempting to match Peter with missing persons from Austria. There is also no official Interpol notice for Peter Bergman, because their only two categories are missing person and wanted person, and as far as anyone can tell, no one has ever reported this guy missing. It would be the responsibility of his home country to do so, but we don't even know which country he's from. On the other side of the coin, it's also possible that the people who received Peter's letters are well aware of his story, but he gave specific instructions for them to not come forward and claim his body, and they've decided to respect his wishes. But of course, we still can't even be 100% certain Peter mailed any letters in the first place. The only other significant movement we know about from Peter's stay in Sligo was when he asked a taxi driver to take him to a quiet beach, and they took a brief trip to Ross's Point. It doesn't sound like Peter was aware of this location beforehand, but it made a strong enough impression for him to travel there when he checked out of the hotel. So we know that Peter subsequently took the bus to return to the beach the following day, and while we don't know the exact time he died, several eyewitnesses placed him on the beach at various times between 4 o'clock and 11:50 p.m. Most of them described Peter as introspectively pacing and walking through the water in his bare feet, but why would he remain at the same location for 8 straight hours? If he was planning suicide by drowning himself in the ocean, perhaps he waited until it was the middle of the night and there was less chance of someone coming along and rescuing him. But for a guy who liked to keep to himself and was going out of his way to erase all traces of his identity, he still managed to make an impression on all the people who saw him. Most of the witnesses who spotted Peter on the beach would later say they distinctly remembered him because he seemed out of place there and something about him really stood out. Well, it's not uncommon for people to end their life by jumping into a body of water. Walking into the ocean to intentionally drown yourself is a lot more complicated way to die. Even though it's been theorized that Peter hoped he would be swept out into the Atlantic Ocean and lost forever, part of me wonders if he actually wanted his death to be as mysterious as possible so that he would be remembered. In fact, I'm genuinely curious to know if Peter might have been familiar with the Somerton Man case, because both men went to the trouble of removing all the labels from their clothing, and this could be the reason Peter intentionally chose a beach as his final destination. They've never been able to determine the exact cause of death for the Somerton Man either, so I can't help but ask the question, are these similarities between the two mysteries just a coincidence, or did Peter orchestrate this intentionally? If Peter truly did want to be forgotten about after he died, then it's truly ironic that his actions have led to him becoming the subject of endless discussion in the media and on the internet. In addition to the unanswered questions about how exactly Peter died, there's also some mystery about the items he did and did not leave behind. Various witnesses from the beach saw him with the small black bag slung over his shoulder and the purple plastic bag in his hands, but neither of these bags were recovered. It's one thing for him to have disposed of items like this in the middle of town, but there would have been a limited amount of places to get rid of them on the beach, unless he carried the bags into the water and the tide took them out to sea. His glasses also disappeared, though I suppose he could have lost those in the ocean as well, and even though he was found wearing a navy t-shirt, he had been seen wearing a long-sleeve pale blue shirt when he left the hotel, and it was not at the beach either. It's also odd that Peter was wearing underwear over top of Speedo. If his plan was to drown himself all along, I wonder why he even removed any of his clothing to begin with, because wearing all those heavy articles into the water would have made it easier for him to sink. The way the clothing was neatly folded almost gives off the impression that Peter was legitimately planning to go for a swim before he unexpectedly succumbed to a fatal heart attack. But now let's explore the personal items which were left inside the pockets of his clothing. Many of them, such as the envelope containing money, were not unusual, but the two items which seemed a bit odd were the aspirin and the wrapped bar of hotel soap. Under normal circumstances, the aspirin wouldn't be weird at all, but the toxicology report showed no traces of any medication, including aspirin, in his system, even though Peter's cancer likely would have been causing him great pain. I mean, if he was one of those people who didn't believe in drugs or painkillers, that would be one thing, but then why would he be carrying aspirin to begin with? These particular aspirin tablets were distributed in Germany by that country's pharmaceutical company, Bayer, so I don't know if this could be seen as a clue that Peter originally hailed from there. The soap in Peter's pocket wouldn't be unusual if he had taken it from the Sligo City Hotel, but the wrapper had the words Mild Soap Hotel Care printed on them, and this particular brand is not made or stocked by any hotels in Ireland. So obviously, Peter must have stayed at a hotel in another country and carried the soap into Ireland with him, but after going to so much trouble to dispose of all of his personal items, why did he still have this on him at the time of his death? Overall, the one thing about this case I'm fairly certain on is that Peter was not the victim of foul play, so it's not like we're looking for some unknown killer here. I do believe his death was either suicide or natural causes, but even if he was a loner, you still have to think there must be someone out there who misses this guy and is wondering what happened to him. And a lot of the recent cases in which John or Jane Doe's have been identified, it turned out that they were living a transient lifestyle and had no fixed address at the time of their death, which is why they were never reported missing, and it took so long to figure out who they were. But I do not get the impression that Peter Bergman was a transient, so if he resided in another country, did he not have a house or an apartment in his name somewhere that went unoccupied and left people asking questions? He was in the advanced stages of prostate cancer and had bone tumors, so were there no medical professionals who were treating him at that time, and wondered why he just stopped showing up for appointments? Hell, Peter was missing one of his kidneys, so unless he sold it on the black market, there have to be records somewhere of an operation where that kidney was removed. Again, the key to uncovering his true identity might be to figure out if he mailed any letters from Sligo, and since he purchased 10 stamps, there could have been as many as 10 recipients. It's unlikely he would have referred to himself as Peter Bergman in these letters, so you can understand why the recipients have never put two and two together. But you have to wonder if there's anyone out there who recalls receiving a letter postmarked from Sligo, Ireland in June of 2009 and never heard from the writer again. Like I mentioned earlier, there are CCTV images of Peter Bergman plastered all over the internet, and his Wikipedia page even has an actual postmortem photograph of him. So unless Peter's friends or family have their own reasons for not coming forward, there may be a day when someone comes across one of these images of Peter and recognizes him. While I already addressed the potential ethical issues of identifying Peter if it went against his final wishes, I still hate the idea of him having loved ones out there who are suffering because they don't know what happened to him, which is why I believe every investigative possibility should be explored. So if you happen to have any information about the identity of the man known only as Peter Bergman, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode on a famous case from Unsolved Mysteries about wanted fugitive Adam Emery, who may have faked his death after he was convicted of murder and has not been seen for nearly 30 years. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have just signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Sarah C. and Stephanie S. Thank you so much for your support. I'd also like to mention that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th, so fingers crossed that it will still happen as planned. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I also wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm sorry.